Well, you've often heard it said, the Hebrew says this or the Greek says this. We'll talk about how to do proper word studies today, right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So how do you do word studies? I mean, it's great to, quote, study the original, to go to the Hebrew, and then a small portion of the Old Testament is in Aramaic, go to the Greek for the New Testament. It's great to do that, but how do you do it accurately? How do you do it without making more mistakes? How are you going to know better than the scholars that work on translating the Bible? How are you going to know when to sort out if a person teaching says, well, the original says this or that? We're going to talk about it today on The Line of Fire. And if you have a specific question about specific words, you're trying to understand what this word means, or a specific word in a verse, you've heard there's controversy over it, I may be able to help you with your specific questions on The Line of Fire. And I want to give you some practical principles for doing word studies. It's Tuesday on The Line of Fire, which means our focus is on teaching, opening up the Word, Bible, theology, apologetics, practical living. So that's what we're doing today. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Online, askdrbrown.org. Click on The Line of Fire. Now, I will dispel some misconceptions today. I will dispel some myths and rumors. I will dispel some popular theories that you often hear. Oh, wow. But I don't just want to burst bubbles today. If I burst bubbles, I'll give you something more solid that's not burstable. Fair enough? 866-34-TRUTH. Now, let me say at the outset a general principle that when someone gets up and says the Hebrew says this and the Greek says this, and they have not really studied the languages for years, generally speaking, with the Hebrew, they've got a great chance of mispronouncing it. And with the Greek, a lesser chance, but still a pretty good chance of mispronouncing it. That being said, it's not a big deal. Oh, it bothers me when I hear something mispronounced, when I hear a Hebrew word and the accent on the wrong syllable or that kind of thing. That bothers me. However, that's not the big deal. So I often tell people, if you know the language better and you hear them mispronounce it, then don't worry about that. They still may get to the right conclusion, even if things are mispronounced. But let me start here and say that Hebrew and Greek are not magical languages. They're not magical languages. They each have their own distinctives and beauty and uniqueness. They're very different the way they function grammatically, the way they function ideologically in terms of how certain concepts are conveyed, but they are not magical languages, all right? By which I mean that if you see, for example, in John 11, Jesus wept, if someone studied the Greek more carefully, they would not discover that it actually meant that he wept tears that were so intense and so unrelenting that they dripped down and touched all of his toes and then formed a puddle around his feet until the tears went up to his ankles. And that's what Jesus wept. No. They're not magical languages. And as a general rule when doing word studies, every word has one meaning in one context. I'm going to start there and we come back. Every word has one meaning and one context. If you remember that, it'll save you a whole lot of errors in doing word studies. I've focused on this, especially in the Hebrew language, for a couple plus decades now. It's a real interest of mine. Proper word studies, right here on The Line of Fire. And your questions are welcome.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. We are talking about word studies, how to do proper word studies in the Hebrew and Greek, how to avoid some common errors. Thank you for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Some simple principles. Hebrew and Greek are not magical languages. In other words, if I'm speaking to you in English now, you understand what I'm saying because these words have meaning. If I say, thanks for joining me on The Line of Fire, here's the number to call if you have a question, you know what that means. It's the same with Hebrew and Greek. They are regular languages with their own beauty, with their own uniqueness, with their own strengths, with their own weaknesses. And Hebrew was a Canaanite dialect. In fact, in Isaiah 19, it's referred to in Hebrew as Sfat Kana'anan, which is the lip or the language of Canaan. It was originally a Canaanite dialect, similar to languages like Phoenician. And in the Hebrew language, the same word that's used for like is used for love, whereas in Greek, there are multiple words for love. Each language has its strengths, its weaknesses, but they're regular languages. They're not magical, which means that you will not suddenly discover something where, oh, the secret. No, it doesn't work like that. You may get incredible insights into the text, and you can't always translate it in one word or one way. Sometimes you have to expand to get the meaning out. But another simple principle, and I'm going to go to your calls, get to as many calls as I can. Every word has one meaning in one context. So let me give you an example. Let's take the word hard. All right, simplest example. I always use this when explaining these things. Let's take the word hard. What can hard mean? Think for a minute. If I say the rock is hard, what does that mean? Well, a rock, it's hard. You bang someone over the head with it. You step on it. Ouch. It's hard. If I say it's rock solid, right? It's hard. If I say the test is hard, what do I mean? That if I step on it, ow, that was a hard test. Or if you hit me over the head with a piece of paper with the test, ow, you cracked my skull with that test. That was hard. No. Hard there means what? Difficult. Exactly. So if you are looking up in a dictionary, and you see the word hard can mean, you know, solid, having substance, you know, however you define hard there. And then you look over and you see difficult. Well, each word has one meaning in one context, which means you cannot take the word difficult and put it to in the sentence with rock. You cannot say the rock is hard. Okay, I see in the dictionary, hard also means difficult. So now, okay, the rock is difficult. No, that's a difficult rock to deal with. He said the rock is hard. Yeah, you can't talk sense into that rock. It's very difficult. Hard to climb over that rock. It's a difficult rock. No, it doesn't mean difficult. It means hard in the, like this, hard, if you heard that. If I say the test is hard, you say, oh, man, it means like rock solid hard. That test is rock solid. No, it means difficult. So it's the same with Hebrew and Greek. You might go, for example, into the dictionary in the back of Strong's Concordance, which I know is going to break some of your hearts, but never use the dictionary in the back of Strong's Concordance, especially the Hebrew. You say, is it always wrong? No, but often it's misleading, and you don't know when it is and isn't. But even at its best, the dictionary in the back of Strong's Concordance, mainly, after a couple introductory comments, will mainly just list the different ways the word, the particular Hebrew Greek word, is translated in the King James. And that's of great value to know that, to see what's called the semantic range, the different words and concepts associated with that Hebrew Greek word. But if it's got four or five different meanings, that's for four or five different contexts. You can't take the fact that in this verse it means this and import it over to this verse. I mean, preachers, teachers do this constantly. You can't. Every word has one meaning in one context. Also, I'm very much into studying the roots of words, in particular in Hebrew. What's the original root? What does this go back to? How can we compare this, say, in other Semitic languages? How is it used in Arabic? How is it used in Aramaic? How is it used in Akkadian, which is Babylonian Assyrian? How is it used in these different languages? That can be useful, and I'll come to that later. But you must be very cautious with that, because often a word develops in such a way that the way it's used today has almost no relationship to the original root. For example, let's say you're studying, and this is a great example D.A. Carson uses, Professor D.A. Carson, in his book Exegetical Fallacies. Let's say you want to study butterfly. Okay, it's got something to do with butter, something to do with flying butter. No, it does not have to do with flying butter. Butterfly, they call it a butterfly because when it's a butterfly, when it flies in the air, it looks like butter moving. No. Unrelated. But people do the same with Hebrew and Greek. I see butterfly, I see the butter there. And they came up with this concept. No, there's a different reason for that word coming together like that. Or the word nice. If you found out that it goes back to a French word originally meaning idiot, what would that tell you? Nothing. May I repeat? Nothing. It would not tell you anything about that word whatsoever. It would simply tell you that that's how it was used centuries ago in French, and then it came from this to this to this, and in English it just means nice. That's what it means. I'm talking to you on the radio. What's the root meaning of radio? Does it matter? Do you even care? What if the root meaning of radio was standing on a rooftop while sitting down afterwards? I made something completely stupid to be stupid. The point is, what matters is how it's used today. When we have a word and we have limited data on it, that's often when the root can help us understand it, or to see how the semantic range develops, how different meanings develop. But what you want to concentrate is on how the word is used in specific contexts. And then how an author uses a particular word within a particular book or over the course of books, that's helpful to look at too. I'm going to give you some practical examples. First, let me go to the phones, beginning with Pat in Brooklyn. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello?
Hello, Pat. Yes, you're on the air, Pat.
Oh, wow. Okay. Just a quick question I had. I'm having a discussion with my friend regarding Luke 11:47.
Yes.
And we're sort of debating because his interpretation is like the King James, where it talks about the sepulcher.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking in the New Living Translation where it says monuments, because the meanings changed considerably, thinking like in his understanding was like tomb, meaning like the message is entombed. And I'm looking at it like this is God talking about idols, and it's an argument against statues and idols.
No, the word means tomb. Sepulcher is how it would be in the King James, which means tomb. But when you would build a tomb for the prophets, it was a monumental tomb. In other words, it was a tomb remembering that person. It wasn't just
right.
A grave site. It was actually a tomb. It's got nothing to do with idolatry. It has to do here with building a tomb. Now, the Greek word for tomb is the word that's related to our word monument, because it's speaking of that. So it would be like building a shrine. Now, does it tie in with idolatry? Yeah. I mean, if you're going to exalt a person. But that's not the concept there. The concept is simply you build tombs for the prophets. You say, okay, this one, you know, let's say Isaiah, he was a great prophet. He was martyred by King Manasseh, but he was a great prophet, and we're going to build a tomb in his memory. And you go there, and there's this little building in remembrance of the prophet Isaiah, and his body is allegedly in there. That's what he's talking about. Jesus said, you do that for the prophets in the past, and then you kill the prophets today, so you're the sons of those who murdered the prophets. But your friend is right, just in terms of the word meaning tomb, but slash monument, not in the sense of building an it's not idolatrous to a god, but it's for someone that lived in the past, okay?
Okay. Thanks.
Great. All right, you bet. 866-34-TRUTH. James in Silver Spring, Maryland, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. I think it's a very important subject you're hitting here, because it leads to a lot of heresy in the body of Christ for this tactic that Carlton Fierce uses to forward the inclusion doctrine and Charles Russell, of course, misinterpreted the Bible to start Watchtower Ministries. But I did have a question concerning the word Barak. I did a study way back concerning the word Barak. It's the first time used in Genesis 1 where it says that God Barak man. And I saw that that meant to be to curse and to bless. And I saw it as being consistent when you look at it through the lens of Matthew 25 or 24, I'm sorry, Matthew 25, where he refers to, which uses the talent. And that talent had the power to be a blessing and a curse. But I wanted to kind of take a weigh in on that.
All right. I'll comment on that on the other side of the break. Thanks.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we are talking about doing word studies. I'm giving you some principles. I'm going to open this up in a little bit more depth in the coming moments and then really over the next hour and a half. So whatever you're not able to catch on the broadcast, just be sure to go to our website later, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire. You can listen to the whole program, and you'll find it all insightful and helpful. 866-34-TRUTH with your questions on word studies. If you're curious about a particular word, what does it mean in the Hebrew or Greek, or an interpretive issue, great day to call. 866-348-7884. James, do me a favor. James in Silver Spring, just back to you. I had a little bit of a hard time understanding the exact question you were asking about the meaning of Barak in Genesis, the first chapter. So if you could just repeat that in brief, that would be great.
Yes, sir. Oh, man, I apologize about that. The question is concerning the word Barak, and when looking it up, I found the word meant, or at least, you know, my studies showed that the word meant to be a blessing and a curse. And I was just relating that to, you know, Matthew 25.
Okay, got it. No. I understand how you thought that. Okay, I can set the record straight for you. I actually have a lengthy article on the root Barak in the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis, an in-depth article that I wrote on that very verb, about 10 pages long. No, the verb means to bless. When used towards God, when we bless God, it means to praise him. When speaking of God blessing us, it means to bless us. So it means to speak good things over, and then in doing so too, when God blesses us, he empowers us. So he blesses us and says, be fruitful and multiply. The reason that you got the idea could also mean curse is that sometimes it's used as a euphemism when in the phrase cursing God. So you have it in Job 1 and 2. Whenever the English translations say that, Job will curse God and die, or he's concerned his children would curse God, the Hebrew says bless God because that's a euphemism rather than actually writing out the words curse God. But it's universally understood what that means. The word itself always and only means to bless. And again, when we bless God, we're praising him, speaking good about him. When he blesses us, he's speaking good over us and bringing those things to pass. So the word has nothing to do with curse. It's just used as a euphemism, a polite way of expressing things, in particular in Job 1 and 2. But thanks for doing that study, and thanks for the question. And if you ever get around to a library, if you want to get the books, New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis, 5 volumes, and I've got a number of articles that I wrote in that. Thank you for the call. All right, before I go back to the phones, and I'm looking at some of the questions here, and there are some great questions. Let me give you an example of how not to do a word study. Are you ready? Never go from the English back to the Greek or the Hebrew. Can I repeat that? Never go from the English back to the Greek or Hebrew. The fact that centuries later, millennia later, a particular Greek word or Hebrew word passes through multiple languages and comes into English and has a particular meaning in English is absolutely, completely irrelevant to what the word means in the original, unless it happens to have kept its meaning. For example, the Greek verb akouo, I hear. It's from there that we get words like acoustics. So this has to do with hearing. This has to do with sound. We see the resemblance there, but you don't understand what akouo means by saying, and the English word acoustic, who cares? Who cares? It's helpful when you're memorizing, learning words in Greek, right? That's useful. Or in Hebrew, you know, to have these connections if you can. But it doesn't tell us anything about the original word. Now, let me give you my favorite example, the Greek word dunamis. Now, the U, the upsilon, can also be written as a Y. So you look at that. That's where we get the English word dynamite. Correct. And it has nothing to do with interpreting what the Greek word dunamis means. Now, I know, I'm bursting the bubble of a lot of preachers, especially my Pentecostal charismatic preacher friends. It's the dynamite power of God. No, it's not the dynamite power of God. Dynamite blows people up. Dynamite blows up buildings. Dynamite destroys. Dynamite does not tell us what dunamis means. Dunamis means power, in particular, miraculous power, sometimes in particular, healing power. So Miriam is told by the angel Gabriel, Miriam, Mary in Luke 1, that the power, the dunamis of the Holy Spirit will come upon her, and that's how she's going to conceive a child. It's not going to blow up. It's going to be miraculous power that touches her. Luke 24, 49, it tells us, Jesus tells the disciples, don't leave Jerusalem until the dunamis from on high comes upon you, until you're clothed with dunamis from on high. And often in Luke's gospel, like Luke 5, 17, the dunamis of the Lord was present to heal the sick. So when there was a woman with an issue of blood who touched him, dunamis came out of him. King James in one place translates virtue. That's incorrect. It's not virtue. It's healing power. And he says, I know someone touched me because dunamis came out of me. How did he know? Was there a woman blown? Did he hear an explosion? And suddenly there was a woman beaten to pieces, you know, blown up into smithereens and 1,000 different parts. He goes, oh, yeah, I know somebody touched me because dunamis went out of me. No. He knew someone touched him because he could feel this leaving his body. And as a result, she was healed. Luke uses dunamis over and over and over, speaking about power, but in particular, healing, miraculous power. So the fact that 2,000 years later, in English, it's the word from which we get dynamite has nothing to do with the Greek. Any more than if the word radio, 2,000 years from now, let's say we had 2,000 more years, 2,000 years from now, in Russian, ended up meaning porcupine, has nothing to do with the meaning of radio here in English. Follow? So never go backwards. The English is this, therefore the Greek or the Hebrew is this. No. If there's a connection because they developed and the Hebrew or the Greek came into English and it's maintained its meaning, fine. Then that's helpful for you to memorize it and understand the word. But never go from the English back to the Greek. All right, a whole lot more to come. Your phone calls and some examples for me and some principles. Here, you want to get into some wonderful study of Isaiah 53. I had the joy of teaming together with some of the top biblical scholars, Old Testament, New Testament scholars in America, to discuss Isaiah 53 on four programs on the Day of Discovery. I've run into a lot of people that saw these great programs on TV four straight weeks by the Day of Discovery. Dr. Walt Kaiser, Dr. Darrell Bach, Dr. Mike Rodalnik, myself, we talk in depth about Isaiah 53. There's footage from Israel as well, giving historical, archaeological backdrop. The mysterious prophecy of Isaiah 53, 2.5 hours on one DVD, just $17, postage paid. So here's the number to call, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. You can order online, our website, askdrbrown.org. Click on the line of fire, or 1-800-278-9978. If you can help with an additional contribution to our radio ministry, that's wonderful, but take advantage of this. And just a quick word, trust the translators. If you find the same translation in 5 or 10 different translations, that's probably what the text actually says.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on the Line of Fire as we talk about word studies, how to do proper word studies in the Hebrew and the Greek. And these days, with software being available, almost anybody can do a whole lot more than could have been done when I first got saved, and you had to do a lot more digging. Now, the digging is wonderful as long as you know how to dig properly. You know, you can dig for years in the wrong place. You're not going to find gold. You dig in the right place, you'll find it. Or you can dig using the wrong tools, and you may end up finding other things than what you're looking for or going nowhere. So it's just important to know the right way to do things. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Right before the break, I made the comment to trust the translators. Now, let me explain. When I was writing my Jeremiah commentary, I had to make constant reference to the NIV and then secondary reference to the NASB. And I got so frustrated with the translation. Oh, I missed it. No, it's not right there. I mean, I got frustrated because I'm looking at it in a micro level and very carefully, meticulously. I'm working on my Job commentary now. And Job is much more difficult in terms of the Hebrew text than Jeremiah. But no, that's not the best. No, I think it's a better way to say this. So I am as critical of translations as anyone can be because it's my field, especially with Old Testament, the Hebrew, and related languages. That being said, you have top scholars working on major translations, and there is not a conspiracy to keep the truth away from you. There is not a conspiracy to go with a party line and cover up, oh, we can't let anyone know what the original says. Nonsense. Nonsense. I've been involved as a reader with some translations, checking up on things. I have friends of mine that are translators, and the goal is always to do our best before God to get the meaning of the text conveyed. Now, you may have liberal scholars who don't believe the Bible is God's word, and they're translating for other purposes, and the nuances they bring or what they bring out could be unreliable. Or you may have a certain rigid fundamentalist approach that just has to go with the way it's always been translated. But by and large, the goal of the translators, God-fearing people who love the word, is to try to render into English or whatever language they're going into in the very best way what the original text says. Now, that being said, there are verses that are difficult. There are verses where you have to make decisions. Every translation, in a sense, is a commentary in itself. But if you spend, you know, a couple days trying to research what the Hebrew or Greek says, and you have not spent 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years studying the languages, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to correct a translation. It's, it should have said this. In other words, there's a reason for what they wrote. So if you read multiple translations, and if you don't own them or don't even have software for it, if you get online, go to BibleGateway.com, BibleGateway.com. You can look at multiple translations for free, multiple translations. And if you compare 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 different translations for the same verse, and they all basically say it the same way, you can trust the translations. And I'm looking at some questions about proper tools to use. I'm going to get into that on the broadcast as well, for sure. So again, any part of the show you miss, I know this is radio. I know some people are listening the entire hour or two, and some people you get 10 minutes in the car or 5 minutes during work. So go to the website, askdrbrown.org, and click on the Line of Fire. Catch the entire two-hour broadcast. But I'm just giving you some basic principles to work with. I've done other shows about Bible translations and which I prefer over others. All right, friends, I'm going to come back, take your questions, and then give you some examples of good tools to use for proper study of the scriptures, word studies in particular.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, on this Tuesday, we focus on teaching, opening up the Word, theology, apologetics, practical living. Today, our focus is on word studies, how to do proper word studies. If you missed any part of the broadcast, go to the website, askdrbrown.org, click on The Line of Fire, and you'll be able to catch the entire 2 hours later today, archived on the website, 866-348-7884. Before I go back to some principles, let me take some specific calls. Scott in Houston, Texas, thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thanks for taking my phone call.
You're welcome.
The question is based in the book of Genesis with Noah and his son.
Yep.
And I'm just curious to know about the Hebrew phrasing, because I'm not a scholar, so I'm at the mercy of those who do know more than I do. But regarding specifically whether or not that might refer to a homosexual act committed on Noah by his son, or by his son, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're talking in particular about Genesis, the 9th chapter. So after the flood and after the blessing on Noah, he and his family, he gets drunk. And here's what the text says, so I'll just read this for everybody else. He drank of the wine, became drunk, lay and uncovered his tent, and Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, walked backward, covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Now, in terms of what is explicit, what's explicit is just the way it reads in the translations here. In other words, the Hebrew does not explicitly tell us anything more. However, the concept of covering nakedness as opposed to uncovering nakedness, it doesn't say that Ham uncovered them, just that he saw it and told them. Yeah. The fact that they reacted so differently and that they covered his nakedness has caused many interpreters through the ages to wonder about that. So there's a rabbinic tradition that says in Hebrew and it's a pretty graphic quote. It says in Hebrew, Yeshom Rim Ser Sov, Yeshom Rim Riv O. Some say that he sodomized him, and others say that he castrated him. So there is that ancient tradition, and that's why when Noah wakes up and finds out, quote, what his youngest son had done to him, he curses him. Robert Gagnon, who's the foremost biblical scholar on the subject of homosexuality, in his book on the Bible and homosexual practice, argues that that's what the text implies, that he sodomized his father. But that is still reading something into the text. The text itself does not explicitly say that. So could it say it? Potentially. But that's as far as I'd be willing to go with that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the good question. 866-34-TRUTH. Carmen in Boston, thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Hi. Because I'm on the road, I don't have the scripture passage, but I'm wondering about where it talks about women aren't to teach men. I've been told that that means their husbands, and I'm just wondering if you can see that specifically it means men in general or their husbands.
You're talking about 1 Timothy, the second chapter, the specific passage in 1 Corinthians 11. There's discussion about women being silent. That's a different context, and apparently has to do with disrupting meetings if they're seated across from one another, as would have been common. So in a house meeting, and the women normally would not have had as much education as men. If they were asking the husband's questions in the middle of the meeting, it could be disruptive. That's the being silent, what it seems to say here. But if we look in 1 Timothy chapter 2, Verse 12, I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Here's the issue. The Greek word here for woman is not female, okay, which is rarely used. Where, you know, female versus male, you normally have woman and man. In Romans 1, Paul talks about females and males because he's drawing attention to the way God created things in the beginning. God created male and female, and Paul talks about that. But almost always in the New Testament, when it talks about men and women, it just uses the word for man, uses the word for woman. Now, here's the issue. Those words also can mean husband and wife. So just like a woman might refer to, you know, my man, you know, colloquial, some parts of the country referring to her husband in Hebrew, Ishi, my man is my husband, you know, the same words. So it can be interpreted either way. It has to be judged by context. That's the whole issue. But to say he's specifically saying, I don't let wives teach husbands, that would really be drawing, that would be reading too much into the text. It's really best to look at it. It says, okay, I don't let women teach men, and say, okay, what was his point? Why? How does that apply to us today? To say that it specifically meant husbands, wives, you really wouldn't glean that from the context. But in fact, if you want to argue it, you know, like I say, the word for woman, gynaikos, that can mean wife, and the word for man, aner or andros, that can mean man, that can mean husband. So the Greek in that sense is ambiguous, but context, I would say, suggests man, woman. All right?
Okay. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Sure thing. 866-34-TRUTH. Harry in the Bronx, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Brown. My question is, the word so, and for God so loved this world,
uh-huh.
is that translated into, in this manner, that word so?
The Greek is thus, so, you know, this manner is the way it would start, all right? Thus, God loved the world. So is really the best way to translate it. God so loved is really the best way to say it, as opposed to in this manner.
Yeah, because, you know, I was talking to somebody, and they were referring to the word, you know, the scripture, and they were saying that for God so loved this world that he gave his only begotten son, and he translated it that God doesn't love the world. It's in this manner that he gave his only begotten son for this reason.
Nah.
And I was a little confused about that.
Yeah, there is a good reason that you don't see that in other translations. Like I say, when you see 5-10 different translations and they all read it the same way,
right.
then you can be fairly sure that's what it says. So thank you, sir, for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. 866-34-TRUTH, Troy in Friendswood, Tech. All right, we lost Troy, but he's asking the same question other callers are. So let me take a moment on that. And I'm going to get your other calls, so stay with us, 866-348-7884. Folks want to know what I would recommend as tools for studying Hebrew, for studying Greek. Now, there's a lot of software now. If you want to invest, let's say you have a few hundred dollars to invest, right? And you just want to get really a solid software to use on your computer that anyone could use. But again, it's a few hundred dollar investment. Now, there are other good options that I'll tell you about in a moment. BibleWorks.com. Go to BibleWorks.com. And you may look at the page and you might be intimidated, like, oh, that's a lot. No, there are a lot of options. Here's what you get. And there are videos that take you through step by step. And I'll give you some other books as well, okay? But And other software too. But this is I use Logos for lots of things. PC Study Bible has a lot of good stuff. But the one that I use for day-to-day to study of the text is BibleWorks. Now, here's what it is. It's text-based. It's not commentaries. You'll find on the page, in the middle, you're at translations. You can put as many translations as you want up there. And if you want to have the Greek up there, the Hebrew up there, the more the merrier, right? Then, if you look in the left column, there's a concordance for whatever translation you're using. Then in the right column, there's an analysis, word study, so on. So what it means is you just put the cursor over the particular word. So let's say I'm reading, okay, hutos gar egapesen ha theos tan kosmon. I'm reading John 3:16. So you just start, okay, whatever. You put the cursor over hutos. And then you see huto, hutos, thus, it's an adverb. Where you hold down shift and go over to the side, the right side, and now you've got most of the major Greek dictionaries right there. And we do the same with the Hebrew, right there. So here you look up, say, in the Freiburg lexicon. It tells you this is an adverb from the near demonstrative, hutos, this, in this manner, in this way, thus, so, with reference to what preceded, so on. And it goes through each of the dictionaries. This is a pretty simple word here, but it'll do that word for word for word. And this is so helpful, so useful, because all the material is there, and you can go as deep as you know how to go. You can't go deep, at least you have some basic references that can help you, right? Much more. I'll be practical. Take more calls. Stay with us.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on the Line of Fire broadcast today. If you want to buy incrementally and build up your Bible study software, Logos.com, L-O-G-O-S, Logos.com, has extensive libraries where you can continue to build, continue to add additional books, commentaries, and then when you search, you'll search throughout all of the different materials you have there. There is also olivetree.com. You get these for your cell phones. I've got this on my cell phone and other places, olivetree.com for excellent Bible study software, and PC Study Bible. This is software where, again, a lot of it, you can even put your cursor on an English word, and it'll tell you what the Hebrew, what the Greek say for those that don't have that background. If you want to get a little library of books, all right, and I know you can get these books on sale for maybe one set for $130, $140. I know for some that's a lot of money. But if you want to do really, really in-depth study, these are great tools to have. Now, I'm kind of the wrong person to ask sometimes about practical tools, because as I sit around my library here, this is maybe one quarter, one fifth of my library. People come in my studio where we broadcast. They say, "Wow, that's your library." I go, "That's maybe a quarter, maybe not, probably an eighth of the library." So, and I'm just looking around here at dozens and dozens of books that are just dictionaries and biblical encyclopedias with word studies and those kinds of things. But just to recommend two sets, very, very reliable, top scholars. I had the joy of writing a bunch of articles for the Old Testament one. There are two dictionaries, the New Testament in four volumes, the Old Testament in five. It's called New International Dictionary. Remember that, New International Dictionary of New Testament Theology. So New International Dictionary of New Testament Theology. That'll go word for word, the major words in the Greek New Testament, give you word study and background. And New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. That's five volumes, and that's the one where I wrote a bunch of articles on different Hebrew words. What we do in these articles is we'll take you through, right, here's the background. Here's, say, for the Hebrew. Here's how it's used in the other ancient Semitic languages. Here's how it's used in that surrounding culture. Now, here's how it's used in the Bible. Here's the general summary of the usage. And then from there, here are specific examples. Sometimes a word is used one way in the history books and used another way in legal material and used yet another way in poetic material. So you have to look. Again, every word has one meaning in one context. So the New International Dictionary of New Testament Theology, four volumes for the New Testament. New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis, five volumes for the Old Testament. They're beautiful hardcover volumes, in-depth, and they're user-friendly. You can look up in the back in English. You can look up, if you can figure out the Hebrew or the Greek, you can look those up and get your way around. And you know what? As I want to get to some more calls. I've got all these notes I want to get into today and examples. I'm definitely going to take more time on this, maybe get a colleague in, one of my fire colleagues from our faculty here, and maybe we'll we'll just take a couple hours and talk these things through. I won't take calls those days. We'll just give lots of examples, lots of tools and things so we can help in a more in-depth way. But I hope everything we're sharing is useful thus far. Janelle in Yonkers, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So my question is based on Ecclesiastes 12, verse 7. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered, okay, I don't have my Bible in front of me, but I know it talks about when someone dies, I guess the breath returns to God, or is it the spirit returns to God? I've always heard two words used there.
Yeah, and of course, the Hebrew word ruach, can, depending on the context, can mean breath, it can mean spirit, or it can mean wind. The same with the Greek word pneuma, which can mean spirit or breath or wind. So the text here, as I'm looking at the Hebrew, Vayashov hafar al haaretz, and the dust returns to the earth. Keshehaya, as it was, Veharuach tashuv al Elohim, asher netana, and the ruach will go back to God who gave it. It's referring to the human life breath, and does that mean the human spirit, or does that mean the life breath itself, as opposed to spirit? It's totally debatable. In other words, it all depends on the theology behind the translation. You could easily translate spirit, speak of the human spirit, comes back to God, or the question is, since all spirits, the Bible never says that all spirits existed in God's presence before and then came down to earth, is it just referring to the breath? But then in what sense does the breath return? So most evangelical translations will translate with spirit, understanding that God breathes life into us, and that life that he breathes into us becomes a human spirit. And upon death, that human spirit goes back to God, either for blessing or for judgment. But it's honestly debatable. A Jewish translation would tend to emphasize breath more, so the New Jewish Version says the life breath returns to God who bestowed it. But you could make a good argument for meaning spirit there, but it's honestly debatable. I hate to leave it there, but it's debatable. Okay. You know, based on the theology of the text, how you understand things, but... You could make a good case for ruach meaning spirit there, all right?
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Hey, look, I'd like to give ultra-dogmatic, super-clear, indisputable answers to everything, but there are cases where it is debatable. Just a reminder again that we've got a wonderful resource. And by the way, if you want to call in and stay on the line, I'll be taking more calls in the next hour, 866-34-TRUTH. So if you call in now, you'll get on earlier in the program, 866-348-7884. As long as it's on the word study issue, we're glad to talk about that. A wonderful resource we have. We do some word studies, and we explain the context and the history of interpretation. Dr. Walter Kaiser, Dr. Daryl Bach, Dr. Mike Rodelnik, and myself, hosted by the Day of Discovery. There's actually footage from Israel. There's archaeological, historical background, and then in-depth discussion about the meaning of Isaiah 53 for Jew and Christian alike. 2.5 hours. This is four TV shows of a half hour each, plus additional material. 2.5 hours on one DVD, The Mysterious Prophecy of Isaiah 53. Just $17, postage paid. As always, your additional gifts help us touch more and more people through the radio broadcast. But $17, postage paid, 2.5 hours of material. Anybody will be able to understand it. And it'll be great for Bible studies. It'll be great to watch as a church together. And it'll be great to sit down and watch with your Jewish friends. So order the DVD today, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978 or online, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, the Word of God is extraordinarily rich. The Word of God is a lamp to our feet, a light to our path. The Word of God is truth. The Word of God is a tree of life. Take hold of it, feast on it, and you will find eternal life. Well, you've often heard it said, the Hebrew says this or the Greek says this. We'll talk about how to do proper word studies today, right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on The Line of Fire, where it's a Tuesday, which means we're focusing on teaching the Word, Bible, theology, apologetics, practical living. And one of the most foundational things of all is word studies. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. So I'm going to be as practical as I can be. I've spent an hour on this already, got another hour to go now. Take your calls on any word study related questions that you have. Any word study related questions you have. What does the Hebrew mean here? What does the Greek mean here? How to do proper studies. We'll do our best to help with that. I want to repeat some of the things I covered in the first hour. Number one, that Hebrew and Greek are not magical languages. In other words, they're languages that convey meaning, each one structured differently, each one having different strengths and different weaknesses in terms of communication, just like any language does. And it's not like if you're reading English and then you could read the Hebrew or the Greek fluently, that suddenly it would mean something very different. Okay? It would mean basically what you're getting in the translations. You just get it, obviously, more powerfully and accurately in the original. But they're not magical languages so that one word has like 90 meanings. If you'll study this in the Hebrew, you'll see it's, well, probably not if it's different than all the translations. Probably not. Probably not if it means so much packed into one word that you can get a whole sermon out of it. Probably not. Also, every word has one meaning in one context. Every word has one meaning in one context. When I talk about going to the bank, I talk about going to the bank, right? I'm talking about, I went to withdraw money from the bank, and then I talked, yeah, this, you know, the bank of the river, the water came right up. It was overflowing. Okay, two different words, right? They sound the same. They're written the same, but they're two distinct different words. And if I say, well, I found this word bank, and I'm going, no, you cannot switch from one to the other and say, well, the side of the river, that's where they store the money. That's the bank of the river. No. Just like if I talk about school, going to school. There's a school of fish. Fish don't travel into school because they study together. No. Fish do not travel in school because they study together. It just means a gathering, a group. So it means one thing in one place, but when you go to school to study, it's a gathering, it's a group, but it's for a specific purpose. Every meaning, every word has one meaning in one context. And you cannot go from the English all the way back to Greek and Hebrew. Okay? You cannot go from the English all the way back to Greek and Hebrew. Meaning, if a particular word has the Greek word dunamis, which means power, specifically miraculous healing power, the fact that later that's the root from which we get the English word dynamite has nothing to do with the Bible, because when power went out of Jesus, he didn't blow people up and destroy them. They were healed. They were touched. Also, generally speaking, you need to trust translations. Meaning there is not a conspiracy to cover things up. There is not a conspiracy to cover up translations. There are original meanings, and scholars are trying to keep that from, oh, if you really find out what it means, it's going to undermine the establishment. No. Translators are working hard. I've been involved in Bible translations, working hard to convey what the original text says as clearly as they possibly can. And then the root of a word can help us understand it. More often than not, the only real issue is, well, how is the word used today? I'm sitting at a table, a desk. I don't know what the word desk comes from, but I know what a desk is, and I know what the English word for desk means. So we'll come back with some specific examples and your questions on the other side of the break, right here at The Line of Fire. Oh, yeah, don't go anywhere.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Doing proper word studies. How do we do proper word studies of the Hebrew and the Greek? Now, by calling, by the grace of my life, I had the opportunity to study academically Hebrew and a number of other ancient languages, languages related to the Bible and the ancient Near East, languages necessary for Bible interpretation, to the point of getting a PhD in that field. So I developed some expertise in that. And then my doctoral dissertation was on the Hebrew word for healing and its ancient Near Eastern context, the root rapha in the Hebrew Bible and the ancient Near East. And then I've written a number of articles on word studies for major dictionaries, encyclopedias like the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis and the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament and some other studies that have appeared in other places. So all that to say that I have some expertise in this, and I do see often that people will come into this with sincerity but not with background, because of which they'll make a lot of mistakes. Now, I noticed someone made this comment on my Facebook page, Ask Dr. Brown on Facebook. They mentioned that when someone who does not know Hebrew or Greek, what do I mean by does not know Hebrew or Greek? Well, you hand them the Bible in Hebrew or Greek and say, read this to me and translate. If they can't do that, then they don't know the language. Of course, I can do that fluently with Hebrew. If you give me a Greek New Testament, I'll work my way through it slowly, because I did not concentrate on Greek the way I concentrated on Hebrew and the Semitic languages. So I know Hebrew far better than I know Greek. Now, with a dictionary, of course, I'll do just fine going through the Greek New Testament. But the point is, if someone knows the language, that means that you can just give them a book in that text, right? Assume they can read that language. Give them the book in that text and say, okay, read that and translate, please. Do you know English? All right, so read what the newspaper says to me. I don't read English. Well, I speak Spanish. I don't speak any English. Read it and translate it for me. You can do that because you know the language, right? So when someone who does not know the language and they've pittered around and studied a little bit here and there, they'll get up and say, now all the translations have this wrong. Well, what gives them the right to say that? How do they know that? I mean, you got to think for a second. What information were they privy to that no one else was privy to? You know, a little knowledge is often a dangerous thing. There are areas of expertise I have that Nancy does not have. My wife, Nancy, 36 plus years. There are areas of expertise she has that I don't have. And I can make a fool out of myself with my ignorance. Because if I think I know a little here, and it's say with photography, or say with gardening, or say with the structural building of a house, he just happens to know these things, or video editing software, photo editing software, or just Mac computers in general. I'm not a Mac guy. I mean, she'll know all these things, and my ignorance is very apparent. So it's like, okay, how do you do this? Oh, I thought, okay, I understand my limitations. The same way, if she wants to know what a Hebrew or Greek word means, she'll ask me, and she knows I have expertise, and she knows I have all of the tools. Scores and scores of dictionaries and relevant grammars and other things like that, I have all the tools with which to be able to answer the questions. So, just as a general rule, don't think you're going to get an insight using a dictionary somewhere, maybe in the back of Strong's Concordance, and based on that, you're now going to be able to fix the translations. You say, yeah, but I know translations have errors. Oh, well, they do their best. Translators do their best, but it's not perfect. So what do? Read and look at multiple translations. Do your main Bible study in one translation so you're used to that and can memorize scripture in that, but then have multiple other translations. And not only is there software where you can get, you know, 30 or 50 different translations of the Bible for almost nothing. Hey, for your cell phone, for your tablets, get YouVersion. YouVersion of the Bible. I mean, it's amazing. YouVersion. You can get all these different translations on there for free. It's just amazing. So if you go online, BibleGateway.com, You can get all types of translations there for free, not to download, but to use, to look at. So you're not sure about the meaning of a particular verse. Look at it in 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 different translations. And if they all basically say it the same way, then, okay, that's obviously what the Hebrew means or obviously what the Greek means. There's not a conspiracy to cover something up. Got that? Now, I'm going to give you some examples, positive examples, but let me give you one more negative example. I mentioned this in passing in the first hour. I'm going to expand on it. Never use the dictionary in the back of Strong's Concordance, in particular, the Hebrew dictionary. I've been using that for years. Okay, let me explain how to use it and how not to use it. First, Strong's Concordance is a concordance. That's what it was meant to be, a concordance. And because it's been so popular, and then the words, the several thousand words of vocabulary in the Hebrew and Greek are numbered, you'll find many of the best dictionaries that are out there, lexicons, will reference to a Strong's number. So if you have the number, you can then go to this solid dictionary to use, which is a much, much better way to do that. So, in short, when you go in the back of Strong's Concordance for the Hebrew, it will often speculate this comes from a primitive or primary root meaning thus and such. And that was some of the scholarship or thinking that was current, say, 100 years ago, whenever Strong's originally came out. Some of it was speculative. Some of it is not accurate. All right. Then after that, it will list all the different ways the word was translated in the King James. Now, that's very helpful to see. Okay, the word exousia, which should be translated authority. Sometimes the King James translates it authority. Sometimes it translates it with power. All right? It should really be translated with authority in every case. Jesus has authority. In all authority in heaven and earth, Matthew 28:18. He gives us authority, Luke 10:19, over all the power of the devil. The dunamis, the power of the devil. He gives us authority over Satan's power. King James says he gives us power over the power. No, it should be translated with authority. But in any case, and by the way, whatever translation we focus on, if I focus on NIV, we'll point out time after time where it could be improved or fixed here or there. I appreciate the greatness of the King James. I appreciate the modern translations. I study the original as much as I can, and then I use many different translations for my ongoing reading and preaching and teaching and writing. In any case, the dictionary in the back of Strong's is really not a dictionary. It'll first tell you about the meaning of the word and its potential root meaning, and a lot of that is speculative. And then it'll tell you all the different ways that the word is translated. Now, that's helpful, but please hear me. You cannot take the meaning from one verse and apply it to another. So if King James gives us 10 different ways the word is translated, a particular word, that's fine, but that's in 10 different contexts. It doesn't mean you can take it from context A and put it in context B. Again, to use the illustration I used in the first hour, the word hard in the sentence, the rock is hard, it's talking about solid, strong. If I say the test is hard, it means difficult. Well, if you're looking in the back of Strong's, if this was the Bible, it would say this particular word. It can mean hard, it can mean difficult. Yeah, in one context it means hard, in another context it means difficult. You can't now switch the context and say the rock is difficult and the test is hard. If you get hit over the head with it, it'll split your skull. No. Each word has one meaning in one context. Now, here's the other problem with the dictionary, especially for the Hebrew, in the back of Strong's. Some of the speculation is really way off. So I still remember when I was teaching at Christ for the Nations Institute of Biblical Studies on Long Island, which existed from 83 to 91. I was teaching there 83 to 87. The secretary of the director said, "Mike, I was looking in Psalm 37:4, delight thyself in the Lord. He'll give you the desires of my heart." And I saw that in the back of Strong's that the word for delight originally meant to be soft or effeminate. And I said, that's why you never use the dictionary in the back. It means ultimately to take delight or pleasure in. The other means to be soft or to be effeminate. Oh, boy. It was there. Check it out if you don't believe me. All right, check out the word delight. Then in Psalm 37:4, check out your Hebrew, your number, and go back in the Hebrew dictionary and see what it says, if it's still got the original Strong's information there. So there are plenty of other things to use aside from that. But if you remember, you can't take the meaning of one word in one verse and then impose it somewhere else, because Hebrew and Greek work like other languages. They're meant to express things with clarity. Not, and if it's an apocalyptic vision and we can't understand what the vision means, at least we understand what the words mean. All right, Clarence, I want to get to your question on the other side of the break. And I'm going to open up a little bit more the Greek word charis, grace. We've talked about that. And maybe the Hebrew word for healing, as we continue to focus on word studies today on the Line of Fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us today on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Talking about doing word studies here on the Line of Fire. And let me give you one principle, what I do when I do a word study. Let's say I'm looking up a particular Hebrew word or Greek word. Let's say the word occurs 30 times, Greek word occurs 30 times in the New Testament, or Hebrew word occurs 70 times in the Old Testament, whatever it is. So then what I do, I've got concordances of the original, and now with Bible software, you can just click on the word in question, the Greek or the Hebrew word, and it'll list all of the relevant words for you. So just have your instant concordance there. So I will look at the words and all of the different usages, right? And sometimes it's good to just put a blank there, or to keep the word in the original. So let's say we're studying the word charis, which is normally translated grace, and we talked about that in the previous broadcast, the meaning of grace. So what I'll do, and that occurs, what, 155 times, something like that in the New Testament, if somewhere around there, if my memory serves me right. So what I'll do is I'll look at that, and I'll look at, okay, here's charis. How is it used? What's the, and I'll just leave the word charis there rather than translate it, to just get a feel for the different ways that it's used. So again, back to my analogy about hard. The rock is hard. The test is hard. His heart is hard. Just, okay, so what's the basic, what's the word mean? And what are the different nuances of it? And then you can kind of, you can get like a, what's like a tree, where you've got a basic concept of the word, and then the different branches to see how it's used in each specific context. So with charis, it has a basic meaning of help. That would be the most basic fundamental concept, it of gracious help. And from there it can lead to the concept of grace and merited favor. From there, it can lead to the concept of gracious help, meaning enabling. Enabling. So that's how I do it. I look at the overall usage, all the verses, and if it's, you know, thousands, it's going to be harder to do that. But I've done some studies where the word's used several hundred times. So look at it, and then you can see patterns. All right, in this context, it tends to mean this. In this context, it tends to mean this. It was eye-opening for me when I studied the Hebrew root barach, to bless, normally in a certain form, livarech, to bless. And when I saw that, I saw certain patterns emerging, but I realized that the most important thing for an ancient Israelite was to have the blessing of God, because that blessing carried divine empowerment. When God blessed the human race and said, be fruitful and multiply, there was the empowering of that blessing. It was just something I noticed just looking. I mean, it didn't change the meaning so much as it gave me further insight into it. 866-34-TRUTH. Clarence in Denver, Colorado, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Shalom, Dr. Brown, to you and your household.
Thank you, sir.
I have a word I've been wondering about for years. It is found in the book of Revelations. Jesus mentions it to the first and third churches, I believe. The word is Nicolaitan. Evidently, these were a group of people that were not preaching the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked it up in the dictionary, and it seems to allude to a church hierarchy, as in a pope, a bishop, and one being above another, and one being exalted above another. Can you shed some light on what exactly Nicolaitans means?
Sure. I've just got a question from you. Yeah, I've got a quick question for you, Clarence. You're not originally from Denver, are you?
No, I'm from Houston, Texas.
Okay. Yeah, just you sounded like a transplant there in the north.
Oh, yeah. We've been there 12 years.
So which weather do you like better, the heat of Houston or the cold of Denver?
Well, during the short summers we have. I enjoy the short summers better here.
Got it.
But overall, I hate cold.
All right,
when we first moved here, we moved to the mountains, southwest of Denver.
I have a two-part question,
if you don't mind.
Okay, I had a side question, but let me just get back to I'll answer your question directly. Oh, actually, the best scholarship we have, the scholars who've devoted decades to the Book of Revelation, tell us we actually don't know much about this group. We don't know specifically what they believe. Now, the words could be interpreted to mean triumph of the laity, meaning people ruling and controlling, but that's really speculative. I'll often hear that in church groups that protest against authority and say we shouldn't have pastors or leaders, and that's what the Nicolaitans held to. We have no evidence for that whatsoever. That's purely speculation. So I'm sad to say that the idea that it refers to popes or clergy or something, or separation between clergy and laity, is really speculation. And others have speculated that it goes just back to Nicholas, who's one of the deacons, the helpers mentioned in Acts chapter 7, and that ultimately that he got into some kind of heresy. But we simply don't know. I've looked at it with intrigue and interest, but we don't know, right? Second part of your question.
Okay. Because I believe that although there were seven literal churches at Johnstown, these letters were written to those seven churches. Because it is the number seven, and we do have the book of Revelation. So I believe there's seven church ages. And that it would behoove us to find out what Nicolaitans is so that
we can keep studying. But here's the problem. And I'm going to have to be concise just because I have a break coming up. But here's the problem with the seven church ages, Clarence. The text itself doesn't tell us that. And then if you read this 1,000 years ago and said there's seven church ages and we're living in the end of time, which is what they believed 1,000 years ago, then you're going to divide the seven church ages up one way. And then if we do it today, we're going to divide them up another way. So it's better to just say these were messages to seven different churches in Asia Minor. Messages to seven different churches, and there's a lesson for us where the shoe fits, wear it. Where we have become Laodicean, like the church in the West, let's wear it. But if you say, well, the seventh and last church age is Laodicean, well, the fact is there are more people getting saved around the world and in the midst of persecution and suffering than any other time in world history. It's more like the church in different parts of the world is like the church in Smyrna, suffering, but yet growing in the midst of persecution. And we here in the West are like the church of Laodicea. It's best not to look at church ages, but rather to look at specifically the messages to the seven churches and then apply them. And yes, whatever we can do to find out about the Nicolaitans, since God hated that, we need to keep studying and pray for some material to be unearthed that hasn't been yet, because we have all the information from the early church and there's still speculation about it. But thank you, Clarence, for great questions. I appreciate it. And I trust you are acclimated to the climate there. You know what? I get calls from Denver all the time, but because he obviously had a southern accent, I was curious as to where he'd come from. And I've told you this before, but when I get to Denver, sometimes I forget the first day that I'm in a higher climate. And I'm like, oh, what's the matter, man? You're short on breath. You just, you know, went up these flights of stairs and you're sure, but what's the matter? It's, it's not me. It's the climate. Back with your questions on the other side of the break.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. We're talking about something very important on the broadcast today, word studies. How to do proper word studies. How to do proper word studies from the Hebrew and the Greek, how not to fall into standard errors. And if you've got a question about the meaning of a Hebrew or Greek word in a given passage, please give me a call at 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Online, askdrbrown.org. Click on The Line of Fire. I want to encourage you to check out the entire broadcast today because I've spent 1.5 hours talking about this, giving different examples. And to catch up really quickly, I've said that Hebrew and Greek are not magical languages. They're languages that convey meaning like every other language does, and they each have their strengths and weaknesses in communication. And one language does one thing better than the other. I've also said that every word has one meaning in one context. Now, there are times when an author will have a double meaning, double entendre. And in a case like that, there's an intentional double meaning, just like in English, but otherwise, 99.99% of the time, every word has one meaning in one context. So I cannot take the meaning of a Hebrew or Greek word in one particular verse, and I'll take it and say, well, it must mean this in this particular verse. No, it's got to make sense in that context. Also, authors use certain words certain ways, and it's important if the same author is using the same word in the same context to translate it consistently in English. And some translations do that better than others, but virtually every one is not perfect in that respect. Generally speaking, though, you can trust the translations, meaning if you'll look at 5, 6, 7, 8 different evangelical Christian translations, and they all say the thing the same way, then that's obviously what the Hebrew or the Greek actually says. Be careful trying to dig up the root meaning. Now, I'm all into roots. I did a lot of that in my PhD study and try to dig down into the meaning of words and things like that and trace their root meaning. But the root meaning is secondary to how the word is used. Here, why does the word butterfly have butter in it? Does it have anything to do with butter? No. Well, I think it's a flying butter. No. But if we didn't know the language, if we tried to treat it in some mystical way, the way we often treat Hebrew or Greek, we'd come up with weird ideas like that. Another rule, you cannot go from English back to Greek or Hebrew. Just the fact that a particular word in English is related to a Hebrew or Greek word today, fine. But you cannot go backwards and say, therefore, it has this meaning in the biblical text. Obviously. And again, there's no conspiracy with translators. They're not trying to cover up things. This is not like medieval Catholicism that didn't want people reading the Bible in their own language or other forms of the church over the centuries, the professing church that didn't want people to have the Bible in their language. You know, Wycliffe and Tyndale, these men hunted like criminals or killed for translating the Bible into English. No. Translators want you to get it, want you to understand what it means. Now, if you'll see a Christian translation says something one way and a Jewish translation another way, that gives you some insight. Is this a theological difference? Why did the Jewish translation read it this way and the Christian this way? Is Jewish translation trying to deny this refers to Jesus? Is the Christian translation trying to read him into the text when he's not there? You can often find that the translator's bias, but the goal of the translator, they're trying to do their best from their perspective to do their best from their perspective to get you into the meaning of the text conveyed in the language that you are reading. So I'm going to give you some specific examples from my own studies over the years. And if you've got specific questions, please give me a call at 866-34-TRUTH. And I think I'm going to bring on one of my FIRE School of Ministry faculty colleagues one of these shows. And we'll talk through different resources, what to use, what not to use, dictionaries, different tools. Keep expanding on this. All right, we'll be back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Okay, it's off subject. It's off subject, but I just have to mention this. This is what you deal with. Yeah, and I don't mind it. You know, public figure, right, speak, that's fine. But how many times have you heard me say on the air that my concerns with Governor Romney as a potential president have nothing to do with him being a Mormon? How many times have you heard me say that? That obviously I differ with Mormonism in very strong terms. But my issues with Governor Romney have nothing to do with Mormonism. They have to do with how he's governed and what his core values are. If he is elected, if that ends up happening, he's the Republican candidate and he's elected, I'll pray for him to be God's man. All right? But my concerns are not due to his Mormonism. So I write this article yesterday. I talked about it. It's on townhall.com. Do you support, quote, anyone but Obama, question mark. And here's an email that comes in. What are you thinking? Trying to push an alternate candidate will definitely hand the election to Obama. But I guess that's more important since you so obviously hate Romney because of his religion. Then all caps, shame on you. Oh, come on. And we actually, I get lots of emails like that when I write on Town Hall, so I don't respond to them, not able to, but God, come on. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, to the phones. John in Fairfax, Virginia, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Michael Brown?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm on the air. Blessing to talk to you. I've seen you all over the internet, and it's just such a blessing to find out about you. But I just had a quick question. You just said something about how Christians translate versus Jews, and I've read like a Jewish translation into English, and it was a Psalm 22, and it didn't say they pierced my hands and feet. It says like a lion, my hands and feet. And I just wondered if you had any insight on that, and I'll just hop off. That's all I wanted to know.
Okay, sure thing. Of course, I can absolutely help you with that, John, very, very easily. All right, here's your answer. In Psalm 22, does it say they pierce my hands and feet, or does it say like a lion, and then in parentheses, they are at my hands and feet? The standard Hebrew text that we have, there are thousands and thousands of manuscripts. It's called the Masoretic Text, but it's really the Masoretic Textual Tradition. Masoretic Textual Tradition, in other words, there are thousands of manuscripts with tiny, tiny variants, basically saying the same thing, but here and there with some variants. The Hebrew text here says ka'ari. Ka'ari yadav raglai, like a lion, literally, like a lion, my hands and my feet. Now, when you look at that, you'd say, okay, something's missing there. So the foremost Jewish Bible commentator, Rashi, who lived in the 11th century, he says, they maul, like a lion, they maul my hands and feet. Others would insert the words, they are at, like a lion, they are at my hands and feet. But you have to insert something because it just says, like a lion, my hands and feet. That's not impossible in Hebrew poetry. You have to carry over a verb or a concept from a previous verse, but it's a little interesting. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls contain copies of many books of the Bible or parts of books of the Bible. And in the oldest manuscript we have of Psalm 22 in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it reads Ka'aru, the tiny difference between the final letter of Vav and a Yud, between the U and the E. Tiny, tiny difference between these letters, just a short line or a longer line. That's it. That text seems to read Ka'aru, which would mean something like they dug out or they bore out. Now, the Septuagint, that's the oldest Jewish translation of the Bible, is the Hebrew scriptures translated into Greek a couple hundred years before the time of Jesus. The Greek there, translating Ka'ari or Ka'aru, reads something like they pierced. This is something like, because that's the way it would normally be translated, they pierced. This is an old Jewish translation 200 years before the time of Jesus. The Dead Sea Scroll could be 100 years before the time of Jesus. All right? So both of these say they pierced or they dug through, they bore out. Now, there are a number of Masoretic manuscripts. Out of the thousands, there are a number who have some variant readings there. Instead of Ka'ari, also read Ka'ru or Ka'aru. So there's a strong argument that you could make, John, that the original Hebrew said they pierced, They bore through, dug through my hands and my feet. And that the reading ka'ari, like a lion, is an erroneous reading. So the oldest Jewish manuscript we have, the oldest Jewish translation that we have, points to they pierced or they dug through, they bore through my hands and my feet, which again would be a very vivid, ultimate image of crucifixion. Now, that being said, we cannot be 100% dogmatic. We just have to say this is not a Christian-Jewish issue. This is a Jewish-Jewish issue. What does the most ancient Jewish text say? What does the most ancient Jewish translation say? What do some of the medieval Jewish manuscripts say? The answer would be, well, points towards they pierced, they dug through, they bore out my hands and my feet. Is it possible that the text should be as it is in the vast majority of Masoretic manuscripts and should just be read ka'ari like a lion? It's possible. But the question is, what's the lion doing? Licking the hands and feet? In other words, it's talking about tearing, ripping my hands and feet. Either they pierced, they bore through, which is the most likely evidence based on the ancient texts, or based on the predominant Hebrew text reading, like a lion. Doing what? Like Rashi said, the Jewish commentator, mauling. So there is it's a great question, John. It is a difference, but it's not so much a Jewish-Christian difference. It's a matter of which Jewish text and traditions and manuscripts we follow. And the overall meaning, which is the biggest thing, comes out exactly the same. 866-34-TRUTH. Mark in New York City, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello.
Yes, hello, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Great. What would be the language if it's a Canaanite Hebrew language? Then what happened with Noah and with going back to Adam all the way?
What we don't know. We don't know. I mean, obviously, Jewish tradition would say it was Hebrew, but Hebrew is actually a development. Hebrew is actually a Canaanite dialect. And for example, Abraham only would have picked that up when he moved to Canaan.
Right.
So when you have Jacob going back to his homeland in Genesis, the 31st chapter, when he makes a covenant with Laban, he speaks in what would ultimately be called Hebrew. And he says, Gal Eid, a heap of witness. And Laban speaks in Aramaic and says, Yagar Sahaduta, a heap of witness. So they would have been speaking something other than Hebrew. They picked up Hebrew as a Canaanite dialect in the land of Canaan. But as to what the original languages were, was it some proto-Semitic, something that would be like a Babylonian or Assyrian or some other ancient variant, and that's what was first spoken? We really don't know. It's a matter of speculation. But if it is related to the languages in the region, it would have been some proto-language that lie before the original.
That'd be Sumerian, language. Perhaps?
No, Sumerian is not Semitic. Now, it could have been Sumerian. That's certainly possible. In other words, that is one of the oldest languages in the region there. But Sumerian is not a Semitic language. Sumerian stands on its own as an ancient language. Now, the Akkadian language, which is Babylonian and Assyrian, they borrowed the Sumerian alphabet. It's really not an alphabet. It's 600 different signs, a pictograph.
Right.
Originally, they borrowed that for their language. But we simply don't know. We know that when we have the Bible, Adam and Eve speaking and so on, that's put in the language of Hebrew. You know, that's how, because it's now given to us in Hebrew. But there's no basis for saying that was the original.
So Aramaic is basically a contemporary of Hebrew?
Aramaic is contemporary of, but in certain ways is older. Aramaic actually goes back, because we know, as I say, that Aramaic would have been spoken by Jacob and Laban in Aram Naharaim and so on. And then from there, the Hebrew dialect, or what becomes the Hebrew dialect, the Canaanite dialect, is picked up. They're both kind of equally ancient languages, but Aramaic may even go back further. Hey,
so
Mark,
the rabbis of today, they swear by Hebrew being the oldest language, and in the Talmud and everything else, so that wouldn't be accurate, obviously.
No, I mean, but that's just everybody has their traditions, and it's not so much based on scientific evidence as much as it's based on that. You know, that's the language that God gave to Israel, therefore it's the heavenly language or whatever. But, you know, everybody jokes about it's going to be their language spoken in heaven. You know what, a couple times back speaking in New York, I was over at NIAC college, and I mentioned there that, you know, it's there was a Korean student that was there, and I said, listen carefully to the English here because this is the right dialect. This is the purest way it was spoken. But Andrew, that you were speaking with on the phone there, just told me the exact mark I'm talking to. So nice to hear your voice, and it was great going to India with you. Was that 1994?
That's right.
And,
yeah.
You're in Times Square Church, and we were speaking there. Yeah, well, and good seeing you also a few weeks back in the city. God
Absolutely.
Bless you, man. All right. We'll
Thanks very
you.
Much.
Okay. 866-34-TRUTH. I'm going to give you an example of word study when we come back right here on The Line of Fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, as we've been talking about doing word studies. So let me give you an example of what I worked on in my doctoral dissertation. If you really want to study this more, get my book, Israel's Divine Healer. Israel's Divine Healer, it's in-depth, it is the most in-depth scholarly study of God the Healer, I believe in any language, but certainly in the English language. Still in print, came out in 1995 as part of the Studies in Old Testament Biblical Theology series from Zondervan. And I spend a good part of the beginning of the book explaining how I did my word study for the root Rapha, heal, restore, make whole. I also have it in shorter form in different theological dictionaries, the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. That's a mouthful. I have the article on Rapha there, revised an article that was written by some others, and have that there. And then in Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament, originally in German, Theologische Wörterbuch zum Alten Testament. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's happening. It's flowing here today on The Line of Fire. I've got the article on Rapha there as well. So the question was, does Rapha mean heal? Does it mean restore? Does it mean make whole? How is it used in the other Semitic languages? Now, it's useful to see how a word is used in the related languages, because sometimes in the Hebrew Bible, a word will only occur once or twice. In fact, okay, cool, we're going to do it today on The Line of Fire. You're ready to learn a technical word, and you can show it off to your friends? Hapax legomenon. Come on, Mike, what are you doing to me? I'd turn on the radio to be blessed, and now you're talking about hapax legomenon? Well, come on, how often do I talk about these things? Hapax legomenon is spell it however you want, but the first is H-A-P-A-X. It's words that are spoken once, that occur once. So in the Hebrew Bible, you have actually several hundred words that only occur one time. How do you know what it means? Well, one of the first things you do is to see, does it have cognates? Does it have examples in the other Semitic languages? Maybe it's a fairly common word in the other Semitic languages that are related to Hebrew, not identical to, but related to. Maybe it occurs frequently there. It just doesn't occur in Hebrew much. And then you see, okay, it means this, 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 and these other languages. All right, that makes sense in Hebrew. That makes sense. So that's one way to help determine meaning. Now, there are other ways. You look at what the ancient translations say, and first and foremost, you look at the context. But I wanted to see the different usages of Rapha. It's over 60 times it occurs in the Hebrew Bible. Some had argued about these issues of physical healing. Did the prophets just use it in a spiritual sense? And as I began to look at the different usages, I was struck by different contexts. For example, the same root for healing a physical body, Rapha, could also be used, say, in 1 Kings 18:30, where Elijah repaired the Lord's broken down altar. Elijah repaired the Lord's broken down altar. The same verb was used. Slightly different verbal form, but the same verb was used. Heal a body, repair an altar. Not heal an altar. Not repair a body. Heal a body, repair an altar. Then I saw that the same Hebrew word could be used with undrinkable waters, like in 2 Kings, the end of the second chapter, where there are undrinkable waters and is causing miscarriages and barrenness and death. And the prophet does what the Lord tells him to do. Elisha does that and then speaks and says, these waters have been rafad, to make it Hebrew English. Healed? These waters have been healed. You don't heal waters. You don't heal waters. You make them wholesome. That would work because you got that whole, right, to make whole. Make them wholesome. So Rapha, when applied to a physical body, meant heal. Rapha, when applied to a broken down altar, meant repair. Rapha, when applied to dangerous, undrinkable waters, meant make wholesome. That's interesting. Then I noticed that in Leviticus 13, 14, dealing with unclean conditions in the body and in the home, the plague of Tsara'at, normally translated leprosy, but it refers to a severe skin disease. But then that same disease could be in the home. In the body, we translate it leprosy, but let's say severe skin disease. In the home, what was it? Mildew. But both would use Rapha. That when everything was said and done, and the plague had left, the condition had left, the skin disease, the mildew had left, it was pronounced Rafat. Healed? Mildew healed? So I thought, all right, maybe the word there would be remit. It's remitted. So the more I looked at this, the more I saw that these different concepts, the healing of a body, the repairing of an altar, or in Psalm, one of the Psalms, it makes reference to the mend the earth's fissures. There's been terrible earthquakes. Rapha, the earth's fissures. So mending the earth after an earthquake, repairing an altar, making wholesome undrinkable waters. I realized that the most fundamental meaning of the root was to restore, make whole. That also worked in other Semitic languages where it could talk about mending or repairing and things like that, even stitching something together. Restore, make whole. And out of that concept, restore, make whole, I saw it just applied in each context. When applied to a body, heal. When applied to a broken down altar, repair. Now, the translation would remain the same, but say 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people are called by name, will humble themselves and pray, turn from their wicked ways, seek my face, then I will forgive their sin. I'll hear from heaven, forgive their sin, and will heal their land. Maybe there is the right place to translate restore their land, because you don't heal land, restore their land from what all of the terrible things that had happened to it. All right, so much more to get into on this, and I promise we plan to do a follow-up show with one of my colleagues, and we'll just talk about use this dictionary, use this, how to use this, how to use this. I think we'll continue to edify you with that. Go to the website, AskDrBrown.org, click on the Line of Fire, and you can listen to all 2 hours of the broadcast with very little repetition, except for where I catch things up over the 2 hours. You can do that later today. But we've got an awesome resource, really digging into the text, really getting into the text, really examining Isaiah 53. What's it about? 4 broadcasts on the Day of Discovery, each a half hour, plus an additional half hour historical archaeological background from the land of Israel. 2.5 hours with 4 top biblical scholars. We got to get into the text in depth. Walt Kaiser, Michael Rodelnik, Daryl Bach, and myself. What a joy to do this. The mysterious prophecy of Isaiah 53. Now check this out. It's 2.5 hours on one DVD, and it's yours for $17, and we'll pay the postage to get it to you. But call today to order. You'll be enriched, trust me, and everybody will be able to understand it. 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978, or go online to order, AskDrBrown.org, click on the Line of Fire. And hey, if you appreciate what we're doing, if you believe in what we're doing, believe in the importance of this broadcast, if you could help with an additional contribution or even become a monthly torchbearer, that would be amazing. And now, my bottom line, the Word of God calls to you, calls to me, dig deeper, study more. Ask God to open your heart, to open your mind as you get into the Scriptures, to give you a spirit of wisdom and revelation that you may know Him better. There are treasures hidden there waiting for you.